From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a member of the state's Pipeline Safety Advisory Board on the new Line 5 agreement between Michigan and Enbridge.
Who in the state right now is going to trust the results of a study from Enbridge? The state itself has said that they have lost trust in Enbridge.
The battling brothers of Battle Creek, Dr. John Harvey Kellogg and his brother Will Keith.
And in his head, there was always this inner voice, you're just John Harvey's lackey, even though he was the Bill Gates of processed food and of philanthropy.
The group Gifts or Creatures with their newest music.
We tend to use the phrase quirky folk music or storytelling.
And theater talk gets you into the holiday spirit.
The production they do is amazing. It is like a Victorian pop-up book come to life.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. What does the newly announced binding agreement between the state of Michigan and Enbridge mean for the future of Line 5, especially the stretch that runs under the Straits of Mackinac? Mike Schreiberg is here with us. He's director of the nonprofit National Wildlife Federation's Great Lakes Regional Center and a member of the State Pipeline Safety Advisory Board. Welcome, Mike. Good to have you here.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, let's start out. How would you sum up your feelings about this agreement that was announced yesterday between the state and Enbridge?
Well, there are a few positives, but I think this mostly goes in the wrong direction.
Why?
Well, one, let me start with the positive. It actually sets a date certain by which the governor and the attorney general will decide on the fate of Line 5, and that's this August. It's been hanging out there a long time, so actually to have a deadline, we all work better under deadlines, that is a positive. But the problem is this agreement favors a particular option, and that is building a tunnel under the Straits of Mackinac. That's what it actually says there needs to be more analysis of. It tasks Enbridge itself with doing that. This is Fox guarding the hen house and sets us on a path that may lead to a tunnel, which I believe is the wrong outcome.
Why do you believe that's the wrong outcome?
Well, we have to think about it this way. Line 5 actually runs mostly Canadian oil to mostly Canadian outcomes.
Heading right through Michigan to Sarnia.
That's right. So the Great Lakes are a shortcut. So we're assuming all of the risks and we get very little of the benefits. What we see put forward by the governor is trying to minimize the risks. So actually doing some things that make the line slightly more safe. I'm not actually sure if the tunnel even serves that objective. But we'd still be assuming the full risks while getting very few of the benefits. The fact is we don't need Line 5. It's not critical energy infrastructure for the state. And the few benefits it does provide for the state could be made up for in other ways. That's where the governor should be focused.
That is a question I think on a lot of minds. What does Michigan get for letting this Canadian oil and energy giant carry these 23 million gallons a day of petroleum products through the state of Michigan onto Sarnia?
Well, mostly we get a risk to our way of life in the Great Lakes. I mean, let's be honest about what we get. There is a small amount of propane that's produced from this line that goes to the Upper Peninsula. There's actually a small amount of oil that's produced in Michigan that goes to market via this line. And there's a small amount of oil that goes to the Marathon refinery in Detroit. Those are the benefits. It's actually a very minor use of the line. It's mostly used to transport energy through the state of Michigan, not to the state. The good news is all three of those uses are easily substitutable with other ways that don't put the Great Lakes in our way of life at risk. That's the good news. We have to think about the ways that these products could still be provided in the absence of Line 5. If we just take the issue of propane in the Upper Peninsula, Line 5 provides, it's unclear exactly, but maybe 40 to 60% of the propane in the Upper Peninsula. What we do know is that you can actually provide the same service via truck, via rail that you get from the pipeline right now. In fact, the propane in Upper Peninsula is trucked directly to residents. So all that Line 5 does is shortcut a little bit of that trucking route. Is it worth putting the Great Lakes at risk for that?
When we look at some of the elements of this newly announced agreement, we know it calls for Enbridge to replace the stretch of Line 5 that runs under the St. Clair River, put a new pipeline encased in a tunnel. What are your thoughts on that?
Doing that would obviously be progress. I mean, that's something that probably should have been done quite a long time ago. It would keep things more safe. Our concern about that is that it's done in the right way. We should not be shortcutting our environmental laws, should not be shortcutting our consultation with tribal authorities on this. And our only concern about that area is this shouldn't be fast-tracked. This is something that needs a deep level of analysis under our environmental laws and under our agreements with the tribal community in the state.
So tunnel under the St. Clair River, but a study under the Straits.
what they're basically saying is we need more information to know if tunneling under the Straits is feasible or not. I wouldn't argue with that. We need more information about that option. I think it's going to turn out and show that the billions that you would spend are not well spent, whereas we've got better options on this. But it's also saying Enbridge, the very company that the state has said they have lost trust and faith in, Enbridge, you need to provide a study to us by May. Who in the state right now is going to trust the results of a study from Enbridge? The state itself has said that they have lost trust in Enbridge. Then they turned around and said, hey, produce a study for us on the future of your asset.
Am I correct in understanding it's the state along with Enbridge who will be involved in the
study? Well, Enbridge produces a study. The state would have somebody that's going to help oversee it. But it's Enbridge's study. That's clear in this agreement.
And that bothers you.
Well, it does. I mean, it should bother the governor, who has come out strongly against Enbridge in terms of a breach of trust over the last few months. It defies logic to then turn around and say, but we trust you with the greatest asset that our state has.
Another question, I would love your thoughts on this. The fact that this agreement requires Enbridge to shut down Line 5 during, and I'll quote here, adverse weather conditions, doesn't that imply that Line 5 is vulnerable and therefore dangerous to the Straits?
Yes. Yeah, so the U.S. Coast Guard just said in congressional testimony that they are not comfortable about their ability to recover oil in the Straits, period. What this agreement says is if there are sustained waves of over 8 feet for a continuous 60-minute period, Line 5 is temporarily shut down. Now, the concept that in adverse weather conditions, Line 5 shouldn't be transporting oil, that makes sense. The problem is adverse weather conditions probably includes the entire winter on the Straits, where we know under ice cover it's difficult, if not impossible, to recover oil. We know under wave conditions as high as 2 to 4 feet, the Coast Guard is uncomfortable sending boats out. So they set a standard saying under adverse weather conditions will shut down, but then they made that standard almost impossible to meet. 8-foot sustained waves for 60 minutes is something that is extraordinarily rare, and it's not the right standard for adverse weather.
So that statement, and I'm gathering people shouldn't take comfort from that.
Well, you know, it's one of those things where the language that says we'll shut it down in adverse weather makes sense. When you peel back the layers and say what that means in this agreement, it's a very specific definition. It's not a reasonable one.
How much, Mike, was the Pipeline Safety Advisory Board involved in crafting this plan?
Well, I can say from my own experience as a member of that board, I was appointed by the governor to represent the conservation community on this. I was not consulted at all. Now, obviously, Enbridge was consulted on this and some of the state officials. Enbridge serves on this board as well. But I think it's disingenuous for the governor to set up an advisory board for him on this issue and then to come to a deal with Enbridge without actually consulting this board itself. I think that's a breach of process and a breach of trust.
Did the board get a heads up or did you learn it along with everybody else yesterday?
I would say I learned it just a little bit before everybody else as a done deal. So there was a courtesy sent out to the board saying this was coming, but it was just before it hit the media. And I just think if you are tasking folks with advising you, as the governor has done, you'd actually want advice and input before cutting this major deal. I will say that it's not the final deal. The governor's been really clear that the final deal in August could be different than this. But this is a major process step. It's probably the biggest thing that's happened on this pipeline in the past several years and under the Snyder administration for sure. So to not use the board that's set up for advice seems like a process breach at a minimum.
So what do you think between now and August is the mission of the board? What do you hope the board's going to be able to do, especially in getting to the governor?
Yeah, I think it's taking a real hard look at the risks that the line poses and what are the benefits for the state. You started by asking what I think is the critical question, and I think that's where the Pipeline Safety Advisory Board really needs to drill down. We're there to represent the interests of the state, not just the private interest of Enbridge. Those interests diverge, and I think the governor has followed a path of what's best for the company, hasn't been looking at what's in the best interest of the state, and I think it's our job as a board to remind him of that responsibility. You know, another thing about this, the agreement actually appears on the Michigan Pipeline Safety Advisory Board's website. That's where you'll find it. That actually implies, of course, that the board was involved in crafting this, even though it doesn't say that explicitly in the agreement. When you go to that website, you see all of our faces on that, and then the link is right there to the agreement. That actually makes it appear to be a product of the board, and it absolutely is not.
So basically, it is one member of the board, being Enbridge, was a part of this.
Enbridge and, you know, there may have been others. Yeah. Obviously, the state entities were involved in this. But the NGO community, the public representatives, the business representative on there, which is Chris Shepler from Shepler's Ferries, none of those folks were involved in crafting this.
Mike, are there any conditions at all under which you would be okay with Line 5 running under the Straits of Mackinac?
Yeah, I think the Straits of Mackinac are the wrong place for an oil pipeline. I mean, that's the thing. My organization, National Wildlife Federation, we're not an anti-pipeline group. In fact, pipelines are the safest way to transport oil from point A to point B when you compare it to ships, when you compare it to trucks, all those other things. But there are right and wrong places. And so you have an oil pipeline that's in the wrong place. And I would say it's operated by the wrong operators. Enbridge, if you go back to the Kalamazoo oil spill in 2010, and you go back to the dishonesty that Enbridge has displayed in even telling us about the condition of the pipeline, how can we trust this operator with our most vital asset in the state and what the University of Michigan has called the worst possible place for an oil spill, and that's the Straits of Mackinac. So I don't believe it's the right place for an oil pipeline, period.
What would you see that would serve Michigan better? How could it run?
We have existing oil pipelines that go south around Lake Michigan, right, that go around the Great Lakes that don't use the Straits of Mackinac as a shortcut. There is excess capacity in those to still get to the Marathon refinery.
So would you go down from Wisconsin down through Illinois and Indiana and
yeah,
across?
Yeah, there's a whole network of pipelines that already do that are not being used to capacity. So let's take the infrastructure that we have to date, some of which has been replaced recently. I don't know if any of it is as old as Line 5 to begin with. That's a much more safe way to transport oil, and we can do that and meet the needs of the state without putting the Great Lakes at risk. There's an easy solution to this.
Did Governor Snyder drop the ball here?
I think that the governor has not really thought this through from the interest of the state. I think he's been looking at – he's got a crisis on his hands, a crisis of trust with Enbridge, and he came up with a short-term response to that, an agreement that makes it look like there's progress. He did put the ball in his own court for an August decision. So this is an issue that is going to go on. There are opportunities to influence him. I believe the Governor Snyder, I believe him at his word that he's a data-driven guy. When we look at the data and what the risks are to the state versus the benefits, I think I'll come out with the right solution on this.
Mike Schreiberg, director of the National Wildlife Federation's Great Lakes Regional Center, also a member of the State Pipeline Safety Advisory Board. Thanks, Mike, for being on the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
In full disclosure, Enbridge Energy is a financial supporter of Michigan Radio. We reached out to Enbridge for comment, and they agreed to have a representative join us tomorrow for an interview. We also asked Governor Snyder's office just why the agreement between the state and Enbridge is posted on the Michigan Pipeline Safety Advisory Board's website if the entire board wasn't consulted. And they sent us a statement that reads in part, and I'm quoting, "While the Pipeline Safety Advisory Board's advice and guidance is valuable on all pipeline topics, the board is a recommending body and can't enter into legal agreements on behalf of the state. This agreement, which is not a final resolution of the Line 5 issue, will be discussed at the Pipeline Safety Advisory Board meeting on December 11th. The board's website is a repository for information related to pipelines and Line 5. Posting pertinent information there about yesterday's agreement or other Line 5 developments makes it easy for the public to find key documents and also eases the public comment process." You can find the governor's entire statement online by going to the stateside page at MichiganRadio.org. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio.
Deck the hall with boughs of holly, fa la 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 la. 'Tis the season to be jolly, fa la 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 la.
It is time for a holiday edition of Theater Talk. David Kiley of Encore Michigan is back with us, and I think it's only fitting we should begin with a real tradition, the fact that the Meadowbrook Theater in Rochester Hills has been doing A Christmas Carol for over 35 years. That's amazing.
It is, and I have to say, I saw it for the first time a couple of years ago, and I'm a Scrooge fanatic,
kind of too.
A Scrooge aficionado. And the production they do is amazing. It is like a Victorian pop-up book come to life. And they started out, you know, with these wonderful Victorian singers with Christmas carols to kind of warm you up. The set design is astonishing. And the actor, Thomas Mehard, who's been playing for several years, playing the title role.
In fact, he's been with the show for 32 years. I interviewed him in the 80s.
It's amazing, and he's wonderful. And I got a chance to speak to him briefly this week about, you know, what he brings to it after all these years.
I am doing something different this year that comes from a writing by G.K. Chesterton, who wrote it in 1911, where he talked about Scrooge having a huge heart and a great generosity right from the beginning and all along, but it just got covered up by all the circumstances that occurred to him during his life. So that always underneath what Scrooge does is this burning love and joy and generosity that is sort of representative of Charles Dickens himself and his huge heart. And I found in approaching it that way this year, less so with all the terrible things that I used to think about, how lonely Scrooge used to be. It was very difficult for me sometimes to be very sociable around people. But now I think with this a different approach, I feel a lot happier. The people around me are a lot happier to work with me. And I'm finding it a much more joyful experience this year.
It sounds wonderful, and certainly if you're a Dickens purist, this is going to be one you love. And also, you can never get enough Ebenezer Scrooge at this festive season of the year because Wayne State is also doing it at the Bonstell. And then in Pinckney, we're getting a different take on this beloved story?
That's right. They're doing a play. It's a relatively new one called Jacob Marley's Christmas Carol, and it looks at the story from the vantage point of Marley, the spirit who was sent to Earth to facilitate the redemption of his former business partner, Ebenezer Scrooge. And it's done by four actors. You know, they're not in Victorian garb. This is a different sort of treatment. They collectively play about 18 characters. This is kind of the backstory, if you will, the story that maybe Dickens had in his mind a little bit, but didn't necessarily get all into the actual story that he published. But it's a lovely fresh play. It's at the Dio Dinner and Entertainment Theater in Pinckney on Main Street, which means you get dinner with the show. And it was a great time. I saw it this past weekend.
Very good. And now we get edgy and we head to Hamtramck to Planet Ant.
Very edgy. This is a very edgy theater. And they're running an original show called Christmas Impossible. And it can be a bit dark, but its message is to show and tell your family how you feel every day. Don't just be waiting for the holidays. There is song and dance, but caution, this is not a kid's show. Do not take the little ones. It's for the grown-ups. It starts out with a guardian angel being fired when the five earthlings she's meant to look at after are deemed unworthy and would be better off dead.
Okay.
And the at times dark story cascades from there. But, you know, if you want something a bit offbeat, sans the Victorian Christmas card effect, check out Planet Ant and Christmas Impossible.
Now we have someplace where you can take the kids.
Yes, absolutely. At the Wild Swan Theater in Ann Arbor, and they perform at the Townsley Auditorium over at Washtenaw Community College, they are doing a revival of Little Women, December 7th to 10th. And you'll be able to find ticket info on our website as well as theirs. But, you know, this is the Louisa May Alcott classic. Their treatment condenses it a bit, the story, to around an hour. That's their hallmark because they understand the attention span of kids. But this is a wonderful production. They've done it before, which I've seen. Highly recommended for families and for kids.
Excellent. Now over to Kalamazoo.
At Farmer's Alley, something not really so Christmassy, but that's okay too. Not everybody wants Scrooge all the time. It's called Honky Tonk Angels. And it's kind of a female version of Million Dollar Quartet, which is that jukebox musical about when Johnny Cash, Jerry Lewis, Carl Perkins, and Elvis Presley got together. This musical features the music and characters of Dolly Parton, Tammy Wynette, Loretta Lynn, and a few others. And it's a hoot. It's fun and classic country music with the Nashville Divas.
That sounds great. I loved Million Dollar Quartet. This would be great to catch. And then we've got some Cole Porter being served up in Dexter.
You're the top. You're the Coliseum. You're the top.
Yeah, at the Encore Theater in Dexter. This is a relatively small black box theater, if you haven't been there, and they're doing Anything Goes. I cannot say enough about this show. The Cole Porter songs speak for themselves. You know, You're the Top, I Get a Kick Out of You, Friendship, Blow Gabriel Blow. These are amazing songs. But the encore has literally assembled like this large, large cast to put on this big period musical from the 30s, I think, when it started. Show takes place on a cruise ship. The plot is beside the point. It's boy wants girl. Girl is engaged to somebody else. Girl wants boy who's in love with another and so on. But the comedy in the show is absolutely delicious. And it is from, as I say, the golden age of these original musicals. It was wonderful. It's going to be a very hot ticket in December. So if you like this kind of show, get your tickets now.
Very, very fun. Well, you can get the details of all of these productions and more by going to EncoreMichigan.com. David Kiley, as always, our thanks.
Thank you so much, Cynthia.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs.
Am I curious?
Am I curious?
Am I curious?
There is so much to talk about in this diverse state of ours. We can't possibly know it all. And that's where you come in. We want to know what you're curious about. If you've got a question about Michigan, something you've always wondered about, send it along and we'll dig into it for you. Just go to the Am I Curious page at michiganradio.org. Finding inspiration for writing and making music can be a challenge for songwriters. But for Brandon and Bethany Foote, inspiration is all around them. The duo known as Gifts or Creatures is out with its third full-length album. It's titled Fair Mitten, New Songs of the Historic Great Lakes Basin. Their music celebrates the rich history and beauty of the Upper Midwest. Stateside producer Mercedes Mejia spoke with Brandon and Bethany about writing music inspired by this place they call home.
Bethany and Brandon, welcome back to Stateside.
It's an honor to be here. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
It's been a while since you last joined us. I think it was back in 2013 you were out with your album Yesteryear, Western Darkness. How do you two describe your music?
Well, we get that question a lot, and I think we tend to use the phrase quirky folk music or storytelling. It's hard to nail down, I guess, the specifics, but that gives you a little bit of a general picture of the type of music that we play and the messages that we tend to give across through that music.
You know, it has this lyrical quality that it's more prose than direct. It definitely has a sense that it's not exactly these heavy stories that you're jumping into and maybe fully understanding right away, but I think that you develop a relationship with them over time.
I think there's an element of piquing someone's interest without it being super literal, and it's not really a one-answer-fits-all type thing.
Well, let's take a listen to the song Two Hearts, Two Peninsulas.
Two hearts, two peninsulas, two hands bound together.
Really exploring with this song and with some of the other songs on this album?
This song is definitely a celebratory piece. It's just kind of really looks at the beautiful rivers, the waterways of Michigan, and the two peninsulas and the unique geographic, you know, makeup of our state. Much of the rest of the record digs a little bit deeper into the history of the state and the region of the Great Lakes Basin in general. It's heavily Michigan-influenced, having grown up here and lived here my whole life. But I think that there's a lot to learn from the past, and there's a lot that we don't know about the past. And in doing so, you learn more about yourself and where you came from and what's come before you and who lived here before you. and even the landscapes, how they've changed over time, and definitely makes you feel a little more connected to the area at the end of the day.
If you just look at the song titles, you have Pontiac's Rebellion, Fort Dearborn, Trout of the Pines, Manitou Peninsula. How do you kind of dig into some of these? What are the creative process or creative challenges that you encounter when you're making music?
I spent some time at the Archives of Michigan at the Michigan History Center in Lansing. The state archivist, Mark Harvey, was really, he's behind me all the way on this project, and it was really nice to have somebody that wasn't necessarily a musician, but a lover of history and the importance of kind of preserving the history of our state. Somebody that really was able to just look at me and say, hey, this is a cool idea. What can I help you with, and what do you want to do with it? And that kind of springboarded me into looking at the places I've been. You know, the Manitou Islands are a place that I love, and this tune Manitou Passage came about, that inland sea passage in Lake Michigan. The Trout of the Pines was inspired by a map that we had hanging on our wall that had a watermark of the Arctic grayling on it. And the Arctic grayling is a fish that once swam the waters of Michigan, and it's no longer found here.
Did you feed on gold?
I just started asking questions of what was life like before we lived here? And what was life like for the native peoples of this area before European settlers came? And then I also look at the struggle that happened between the European settlers and the natives. You know, Pontiac's Rebellion is exactly looking right at that, and that difficulty of just imperialism and that battle of what's right and what's wrong at the end of the day.
When tribes came to be, the mighty Mississippi, the mitten seized the call. On that dark and bloody day, the fort was meant to stay. My heart
on it a little bit, but what is it about making music in Michigan that you think is special, Bethany?
Well, I think Brandon and I both feel really fondly about this state. We both have roots here. I have so many positive memories of going over to Lake Michigan, driving over from Lansing, from, you know, the middle of the mitten, and spending time on the sand dunes and in the water with my family and with friends. Both Brandon and I have pretty magical memories of exploring the woods near our home or in the northern woods, and just the imagination that goes along with that. I'm an early childhood educator, and I think part of that influences the way that I see music and the way that I see this project and how we kind of cast vision for the next generation and think about what is it that we're leaving for the children, and what is the state going to look like for our son and for his friends and even for his children. So there's a little bit of those kind of themes tied in as well. But overall, there's just such a strong community here in Michigan, and we are really blessed to be a part of it. We feel a huge sense of encouragement and camaraderie from fellow musicians here in Michigan, and I think there's a sense of pride and ownership that comes with people from Michigan that's maybe unique to this state, and we certainly feel that pride and love to share some of that magic with other people about this place that's sometimes off the beaten path and maybe not visited by others as much as it maybe should be.
Well, Bethany, Brandon, thanks so much for talking with us on Stateside.
Thanks, Mercedes.
Thank you so much.
Army of the Northwest for Dearborn Massacre. Torched in quarter hour, the load, the load. Cold, windy city, Michigan shore be still. Back in all the fallen, the load, the load.
You're listening to Stateside, and if you miss any part of today's show or you want to give it another listen, it's easy to find it on our podcast. Just go to michiganradio.org and click on podcasts, and it'll take you to the link. Coming up, they changed the way we eat breakfast. Battle Creek's battling brothers, John Harvey Kellogg and younger brother Will Keith.
He was one of these great Americans that shaped the American century. And yet he was the saddest man.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Of Kellogg's, good morning. The best to you each morning. K-E-L-L.
Oh, double good.
Kellogg's best to you.
That chirpy, cheery jingle meant breakfast to countless families over the generations. You open that box of Kellogg's Corn Flakes or maybe Rice Krispies, pour on the milk, and you've got breakfast. But the story behind that catchy jingle and that bowl of cornflakes, it's a bitter family feud. The Seventh-day Adventist religion, a healthy, holy lifestyle, and some sexual abstinence. It's the story of Dr. John Harvey Kellogg and his younger brother, Will Keith Kellogg, both of them from Battle Creek. A story told by U of M medical historian Dr. Howard Markell in his new book, The Kelloggs, The Battling Brothers of Battle Creek. And Howard, battle they did, which we will get to. But what was it that drew you to their story to turn it into this book?
Well, originally I was drawn to Dr. John Harvey Kellogg because I'm a physician and a medical historian. And I knew of him and his work. And in medical school, I used to read his magazine, Good Health, was in the stacks of the old Taubman Library. And so when I was bored or I didn't want to jam this fact or factoid into my head, I would read them. So I knew his papers were all here at the University of Michigan at our Bentley Historical Library. So I was drawn to him initially. And then the more I uncovered his life, the more I met up with his little brother, Will. And the story was so compelling and the conflict was so great. I love conflict. I love writing about conflict. I don't like it in my own life, but I love writing about it. And it just – the story just kept unfolding and unfolding and getting better and better.
So when the Kelloggs moved to Battle Creek in 1856, what was the typical American breakfast like?
Oh, my. Americans ate very badly by today's standards, whether it was breakfast, lunch, or dinner. But breakfast was often fried up cured meats, bacon and ham. So there's a great deal of fat and salt. Potatoes were often consumed, and they were fried up in the congealed fat left over from the night before.
So we'll make these potatoes really unhealthy.
Really crispy, but yeah. Really unhealthy.
Yeah.
There might have been mugs of cocoa and coffee, tea, sometimes boiled rice that was doused with molasses or fat. And it took quite a bit of time to make these meals. The healthiest meal might be a bowl of mush, but these whole grains took hours to boil and cook so that they were soft and palatable. But it was not a healthy diet by any stretch.
And it's certainly, you can tell that John Harvey Kellogg was extremely fixated on stomach and intestinal health from a very, very early age, which carried through into his medical school years.
He was the poor man. First of all, his mom, before they got into a healthier diet, made the same type of food that I just described. His favorite meal was braised oxtails in a greasy, heavy brown gravy, and he loved eating. And he ate a lot of candy, too. And he developed colitis, a bloody colitis with scars on his intestine. He developed terrible constipation and hemorrhoids. And one of the most painful things known to mankind, an anal fissure, which is a tear in that region, which does not heal very quickly because you open it up almost every day. And it hurts like the dickens. It brings new meaning to the expression, you're a pain in the fill in the blank.
A big part of the story, as well as the pretty rotten diet Americans had, is the Seventh-day Adventist Church, centered right in Battle Creek. And that's why the Kelloggs came to Battle Creek, right?
Yeah. So the Kelloggs originally settled in Flint from Connecticut, but they were a religious family. And this was around the time of the Second Great Awakening. And the Seventh-day Adventists were just starting their denomination. And they settled in Battle Creek. That was the Vatican of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, which was founded by James and Ellen White. Ellen White was a self-proclaimed prophetess. She had conversations with God or testimonies with God and would then tell her flock about them. So there was a lot of Christianity. It was the Adventists, so they believed in the coming of Jesus Christ, the second coming, and only a select few, the most pious, would ascend to heaven, something that really disturbed John Harvey Kellogg as a young boy, wondering, will I be holy enough to make that ascent? And there were a great many what Ellen called health reforms, which, you know, Christianity in the mid-19th century in America had a lot of health issues connected to their spiritual and religious issues. No wonder, because their flock was dying like flies. So she had all these health reforms to have a clean body. That was your temple, so to speak. So you were spiritually clean, you were physically clean, you were sexually clean. So the diet that one ate should be a grain and vegetable diet. That's how she interpreted Genesis, for example. No meat of any kind, no alcohol or caffeine, no tobacco, no condiments, because this food was often tasteless and a lot of spicy condiments were developed, you know, spicy mustards and so on. And so none of those that she felt were either excitatory or produced bad health. And of course, she also prescribed a chaste lifestyle where sex was only for procreation.
So young John Harvey Kellogg grew up in this religion and then got a lot of support, as you point out, from the Whites in his medical studies because they had their eye on him to be the medical director of their Western Health Reform Institute in Battle Creek. What was that?
You're right. He was their chosen one, obviously brilliant from even as a child or a young man. And they wanted to expand the health reform part of their ministry by having an institute of health reform where people would come and learn about the health reforms, eat a healthy diet, maybe exercise, what have you. The Western Health Reform Institute was basically a house, and there were some quacky doctors who gave boring, droning lectures and some very tasteless food. And those who came rarely came back. And so they were having a real, as we say in the hospital business, a census problem. They couldn't fill the beds.
And then John Harvey Kellogg becomes the director once he gets out of medical school,
right,
which they underwrote for him pretty much,
yes,
right? And comes up with an entirely new word to name the place. And it's a word that we would get, but he invented the word sanitarium?
Yes. He invented the word sanitarium.
And what was that new word supposed to tell the world about this place?
Well, the root of it, sanitas, which is Latin for health, it was really a place of health, or as he liked to call it, a university of health, where people were taught how to live healthier lifestyles and in a way that was not reform. You see, he knew that nobody likes reform, John Harvey said. No one likes the idea of reform. But the idea of going to a university of health, people might be willing to do that.
Pretty good spin.
It was a very good spin, and he was a great wordsmith, and he was one of his great talents was the ability to write and come up with metaphors and similes that people would understand. And so he changed everything. He changed the diet. He made it much more palatable. He changed the activities so they were fun. He developed all sorts of exercise machines that would get the pounds off. There were sing-alongs and entertainment. And, of course, the greatest feature of the Battle Creek Sanitarium Planetarium, as he named it, was John Harvey Kellogg. He was just a brilliant showman.
So he was kind of a rock star, if you will, in the health movement. And when the place burned down, as you describe in the Battling Brothers of Battle Creek, he pulled out the stops and really rebuilt it and offered so many more services at the San, and I as he called it. And I had to laugh that the Sanctum Sanctorum was basically what the colonic room, the enema room.
Yeah, that was his special place.
Oh,
yeah, it's a special place. Yeah. So the San burnt out, the wooden structure burned down in 1902. He built a glorious and much better one, a grand hotel, basically, that famous people from around the world came to.
Like?
Booker T. Washington, Sojourner Truth, Amelia Earhart, Johnny Weissmuller, Eddie Cantor, William Howard Taft, Warren Harding, John Philip Sousa. I could go on and
Battle
on.
Creek was really bustling.
Yeah,
I'm
it
sure.
was the number two stop on the Michigan Central line, with Detroit being number one.
Although I note, as you note in your book, cynics called the patients battle freaks. So
battle
not
freaks.
Everybody was on board with this.
Yeah. And they called themselves that.
Now, we have to bring Will Keith Kellogg into this. Is it fair to say he was the flunky, the whipping boy around the San?
Well, for a lot of his life, Will was pronounced poor Will, because that's how everyone referred to him. He was more than just a flunky or a lackey to Dr. John Harvey Kellogg, even though he felt that way and wrote about it in his own diary. He was younger by 8 years. John never missed an opportunity to humiliate or physically harm or psychologically harm his little brother.
Going back to when they were
little Going back boys. To they were little
yes.
kids.
Wow.
In fact, Will's memory of his brother as a child, this is an old man, but he's remembering it. On cold winter nights, John Harvey would put his feet on Will's back to warm them. That's his memory. And John would taunt Will and treat him badly. Now, Will was considered dim-witted, as they said. He didn't do well in school, and he barely finished what we call high school. And it turned out he needed glasses, and he didn't know he was nearsighted till he was 20 years old. That's one reason why the Will Kellogg Foundation is very interested in eye issues, and the University of Michigan has the Kellogg Eye Institute.
All right.
The other thing that he was concerned about were dental issues, because he lost most of his teeth when he was still a teenager, and we have the Will Kellogg Foundation Dental Institute at the University of Michigan.
There we go. Yeah. And he did work at the San, and then it turned out he was a genius in business and everything John wasn't.
Right. So, you know, you need always an outside guy and an inside guy in every business partnership. So John was the outside guy, drumming up the business, bringing in the people. But Will was more than a lackey. He was a brilliant administrator. And this was a huge place. It had thousands of employees. It had, you know, farms and kitchen and laundry and maids and nurses and doctors. And Will had to run all the what we call today human resources. He had to run all the billing, all the accounting, all the vendors. He dealt with so many people, and he did it all in his head. And he was just incredible at doing so. And of course, John could not only treat him badly, but he could trust him because he was his brother. But he never got the credit for doing that. He never got an accolade. He never had a formal title. And this is why Will felt at the age of 46, I'm a flunky. I'll never be more than John Harvey's flunky, is what he wrote.
I'm talking with Dr. Howard Markell, U of M medical historian. His latest book, The Kelloggs, The Battling Brothers of Battle Creek. And now it's time to ask about the cornflakes. Let's talk cornflakes. What led to the birth of the cornflake?
Okay. First, a disclosure, I love cornflakes, but I love sugar-frosted cornflakes even more. The idea was to create a food that was highly digestible. Now, John Harvey was obsessed not only with how the colon worked or the GI tract worked, but he wanted to develop foods that were easy to digest and would not cause an upset stomach. And so he had a theory about grains that if you bake them for a long period of time at a high temperature, you would break that starch molecule into a simple sugar, dextrose, which is true. That does happen. And when you eat that, it would be easily digested as soon as you start chewing it and mixing it with your saliva. Now, the first thing he made was a Zweiback biscuit, a hard double-baked biscuit. And as the story goes, a woman broke her dentures while biting into this biscuit, and she wanted $10 for new dentures, which was a considerable amount of money back then.
It was.
This is the 1880s. And John Harvey didn't want to do that. So then he started breaking down the biscuits into crumbs. That was okay. It was his first cereal. It was called granola.
Interesting.
There was another guy named James Jackson in New York who was making his own cereal called granola, similar. His was wheat crumbs. John Harvey said, well, ours are wheat with a little bit of corn and some barley crumbs. The lawyers prevailed upon him, and he changed the name to Granos, which was still the wheat crumbs. And people liked that, but it wasn't a big hit. There was another guy named Henry Perkey who made something we now know as shredded wheat. And
yes,
he figured out how to spool out the wheat, boiled wheat, into these tiny threads and then wrap it up into the biscuits we know as shredded wheat. And John Harvey tried to buy the patent for that, and it didn't go well. He was always bad at business. He had a deal, and then he wanted a better deal, and Perkey said, you know, forget it. And he made a mint on his shredded wheat. But John Harvey was, you know, always optimistic. He came back to Battle Creek, and he told his brother, we'll create something better. And so they worked with, you know, various batches of dough, and they did various things to it. They spun it, they rolled it, they flattened it. And finally, his wife gave an advice, let's flatten it even more. Let's make it like paper thin. And they baked it a certain way, and they actually had a mistake. And the mistake was John Harvey was called to see a patient. That's the way he tells the story, and he couldn't finish that batch of dough. Will said they were just tired and they wanted to go to bed that night. But Will was very frugal and he put the dough up for another day. He didn't want to throw out that batch. Well, what happened is that dough became tempered. And bakers know about this. Basically, the water content evens out throughout the batch of dough. It's not just in little pockets. And it also becomes slightly moldy. It's not moldy enough to alter the taste, but it's slightly moldy. And so when they rolled out that batch, it came out in perfect flakes when they carved it up and they had it.
As we go through your book, you would think that this would be John Harvey Kellogg's triumph, but ultimately there was a huge legal battle. And how did it wind up that Will Keith got the rights to the family name? And it was, when we think of the company producing the cereals, and boy, it is something, $14 billion a year.
It's a huge international corporation to this day.
How did that wind up in Will Keith's domain?
Well, Will was, you know, working with him. Even though John Harvey took the original patent in the 1890s on flaked cereals, Will was right there and was more than just an assistant. He was coming up with new things all the time. And part of Will's genius was not only his administrative ability, his palate was perfect. He really knew what tasted good. And so the original flakes were made out of wheat, which didn't taste all that well. And then he used corn because it was cheaper and sweeter. And you had to do all sorts of machinations to make corn flakes. And Will worked that out. And then Will left his brother's employ in 1906. I'm going to start my own company. It was called the Battle Creek Toasted Corn Flake Company. We now know it as Kellogg's. And he bought the rights for the corn flakes and the patent. And John Harvey got a ton of corn flake dividends, which made him later on a very wealthy man. And Will added a little bit of salt and a little bit of sugar, and that made corn flakes taste like corn flakes. And that just became the hit of the century. It was started in 1906, but everyone loved it. Will advertised to a fare thee well in all sorts of creative ways. He surrounded himself with brilliant advertising men. They knew how to sell the grocers and the food jobbers and so on. And everywhere you turned was an ad for Kellogg's Corn Flakes. And of course, American mothers loved it because now you could just pour cereal out of a box.
You weren't up at 4 a.m. lighting
fire to
make the mush.
And even Dad could make cereal.
Yeah.
And a lot of other things coalesced at that time to make Kellogg so popular. You had train travel, you had national branding, and you had clean, pasteurized milk on a national basis. So you got to have milk to have a bowl of cornflakes, right? So cornflakes just became the hit of the century. Now, the doctor didn't like that. He didn't like the fact that his brother was successful. And so the doctor came out with his own line of cereals, also called Kellogg's, and they didn't taste as good. And that bothered Will, who had a fiduciary responsibility to his company to battle off people like that. And Will was very good at fending off competitors. He was quite the businessman. And so it turned out to be a giant lawsuit. It started in 1910. It went all the way to 1920. Will sued John Harvey. John Harvey sued Will, and on and on and on. And it went all the way to the Michigan State Supreme Court. And the question was precisely what you ask. Who had the rights to the name Kellogg? Who was the real Kellogg that could advertise their wares? And gosh darn it, Will won because the judge said, look at all these ads, millions and millions of dollars of ads. Millions of Americans read these ads or hear about it on the radio, et cetera. And when you hear the name Kellogg, you think Kellogg's Corn Flakes.
They never spoke again, did they?
Well, they spoke occasionally, but rarely.
Not well.
And they had terrible fights. Their last meeting a few months before John Harvey died, John wanted some money to save the ailing sanitarium, which really went under during the Depression. Will wanted to close it down because, as he dealt with his business enemies, he did not want John Harvey to have a physical legacy. It turned into an ugly, ugly fight, and then they never spoke again.
Dr. Howard Markell, University of Michigan medical historian. The book is The Kelloggs, The Battling Brothers of Battle Creek. And there is indeed remarkable history in that cereal bowl as you look at your Kellogg's Corn Flakes. Thank you so much, Howard.
Thanks so much, Cindy.
Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.